From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on May 13, 2009, on the floor of the United States House of Representatives. Congressman Bob Inglis of South Carolina introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Congressman Inglis said he saw the issue of energy infrastructure as one of national security, and he supports a carbon fee and dividend as a means of reducing our dependence on foreign oil and growing jobs. Now, big deal, right? This is just another Democrat with another energy plan. But no, Bob Inglis is a Republican, and just a few years earlier, he had said that climate change was only a figment of Al Gore's imagination. Now here he was on the floor of the House, telling his fellow Republicans that climate change was not only very real, but a serious threat. For his efforts, Inglis received a primary challenge from three other Republicans the next year, and he was defeated by Trey Gowdy, who said that by declaring climate change to be real and man-made, Congressman Inglis had crossed over to Satan's side. The New York Times quoted Inglis after his defeat as saying that nothing factored more than his embrace of climate science in his defeat, but he said he did not regret it, because climate change is real. So what now? Well, he is one of many people working toward solutions that not only might slow climate change, but improve the economy. And our guests today are part of the Citizens Climate Lobby. This is what they do across the country, here in local chapters. They're here to discuss a carbon fee and dividend, yes, but also local activism, how it works, how to get involved, and how some of these proposals differ from one another. You've probably heard carbon tax, cap and trade, carbon fee and dividend. Let me go ahead and welcome my guests for the hour. Tim McGowan is the founder of the Rochester chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and he's the guy who I always bug whenever I want to know about carbon fee and dividends. So it's nice to see you in studio.
Good to be here.
Also here is Abby McHugh Griffith. She's the co-leader of the local chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Abby, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having us.
And on the phone is Mark Reynolds. He's the executive director of the National Citizens Climate Lobby. Mark, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it is important, I think, to distinguish. This is not a partisan conversation. This should not be an ideological conversation. Debates about policy, absolutely normal, I think healthy, can get heated. Debates about whether it's happening or not, let's listen to a little bit more of what then Congressman Inglis, well now, this is what he said at a TEDx talk in Florida when he talked about climate change from a conservative perspective. This is first what Inglis admitted. This is what he did to belittle Al Gore when he was in Congress.
Had a very successful press conference one time, sacks of coal, wood for fire burning, and we said Al Gore is going to raise these poor people's energy prices here in the cold Greenville, South Carolina. Of course, not many people heat with coal or wood in Greenville, South Carolina. Some do. Very successful press conference. It was all based on ignorance for me. I had not looked into the facts at all. All I knew was that Al Gore was for it, and therefore I was against it, because I represented perhaps the reddest district in the reddest state in the nation.
That is a remarkable admission, but Congressman Inglis says that was par for the course for Republicans at the time, and he says in many ways still now. Well, now what is he doing? He's not in Congress. He got voted out. He says he's not going to get elected again with this stance, but he says progressives across the country, you've got to work with conservatives if you want a carbon fee and dividend or any climate-based policy. So here's what he does now. Here's Inglis describing why conservatives should be embracing these ideas.
I have the wonderful opportunity now to travel the country and tell the champions of free enterprise to overcome their inferiority complex. They apparently think they're no good at energy and climate. And so when the topic comes up, my friends, my conservative friends, the people that I identify with, shrink in science denial because we think we're no good. But actually, we're very good. We're the kid in class who has the answer. Raise your hand. You got the answer. It's free enterprise, and you have known it all along. What it takes is simply this, a true cost comparison between the competing fuels. Put all the cost in, take all the subsidies out, and free enterprise can fix climate change.
All right, so we're not going to spend the hour on his specific proposal, but I think this is a chance for us to open the hour by saying, when you hear Citizens Climate Lobby, when you hear climate policy discussion. It does not have to be right-left ideological. Mark Reynolds is the executive director of the National Citizens Climate Lobby, and my guess is you have people of all stripes, all religions or no religions, Republicans, Democrats, and beyond. Yes, Mark?
Yeah, and I mean, starting with, you know, Bob Inglis is on our board, former Secretary of State George Shultz is on our board, and if I could just say a little bit more about Bob Inglis and what an extraordinary human being he is. You know, in 2009, he was asked by the Miami Herald, how could a Republican from the most conservative district in the country not just be talking about a new tax, but a carbon tax? How could that possibly be the case? And his response was, if you're not going to do the right thing, you should go home. Now, certainly we wish more of our members of Congress to talk like that, but he is really a remarkable human being. And the other thing about 2009 that I think is important, in 2009 the House actually passed the Waxman-Markey bill, which was a cap-and-trade bill, and yes, it was way too long and it was way too complicated. But it was a remarkable political achievement. And when after there was a failure to get something done in the Senate, there's a political scientist at Harvard named Theda Skocpol. She wrote over a 100-page criticism, and at the heart of her criticism were two matters. One is she said no matter what you do to mitigate global warming, costs will go up, and if you don't give all the money back to households, they're not going to support it. And two, she said that all of the support for that legislation existed in the Beltway, and that's not where it needed to be. It needed to be back home in district, and that's why I think the efforts of our local chapter are so important, because they regularly meet with Representative Slaughter's office and also Mr. Schumer and Ms. Gillibrand. So we do think that local effort is really the crucial issue of being successful, and that's why we think the local efforts are so important.
Mark, how many chapters of the Citizens Climate Lobby now?
There's over 300 now. In 2009, there were 6 chapters and 24 volunteers, and the organization has been doubling in size every year for the last 7 years. And I think that's because we are offering a solution. You know, in 2011, Rob Willer wrote a paper called Apocalypse Soon, Dire Messaging is Counterproductive on Global Warming. What a study actually showed is if you only give people the problems related to climate change, it actually hurts more often than it helps. But if you offer a solution, it tends to bring people along. So I think that that's been really attractive for a lot of people. And also because we're the kind of organization, you know, David Brooks had another great piece in the Times today where he talked about, you know, there's a big difference between what brings people to Congress rather than what happens to them once they are in Congress. And I think our people are always going in and reminding members of Congress what brought them there, not the difficult things that they have to deal with once they get there. And I think that people like appealing to what is big in people.
Mark, if you got some pull with Congressman Inglis, maybe some separate program, we'll bring him in on more of the conservative perspective and just do an hour on the conservative perspective. And So you start working on that for me, and that will be a big get here.
Okay, we can definitely do that. He'd be happy to do it, so we'd be happy to coordinate that.
We're talking to Mark Reynolds, the executive director of the National Citizens Climate Lobby. In studio, I want to ask Abby McHugh-Griffith, who's the co-leader of the local chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. CCL locally is how big now? How many members, and how do you compare that? What kind of growth have you seen?
So we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 very active volunteers, but we have over 400 people on our mailing list. So, you know, we're getting the word out, and we're a presence in the community, definitely. We table at a lot of events. We are certainly meeting with members of Congress. We've had letters to the editor published in the DNC. So we're getting the word out. But about 20 very committed volunteers.
We've had almost 1,000, actually over 1,000 postcards signed by individuals to our various representatives indicating the need for federal climate change legislation.
Well, listeners, if you have questions about a carbon fee and dividend, which we're going to get into, which is a specific idea, we'll also talk other policy and what is out there. Again, as Mark just said, it's not just about sort of doomsday discussion, but also pragmatically what might work. This is a good chance for you to call in and have some questions answered or maybe kick it around, debate some ideas. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Are you an optimist that we can do something like this? Is the national election? Abby and Tim are going to help give us a little bit more optimism about what's going on nationally, because right now a lot of people are seeing the national scene and they're not that hopeful that legislation has been passed, that things can get through. Before the hour began, they were trying to revive some life into me, some optimism, I should say, about that. And I'm sure Mark will weigh in, too. But listeners, if you want to find us on the phones, you can do that. You can find me on Twitter, at Evan Dawson, and you can email the program, edawson@wxxi.org. I just also want to ask Tim McGowan one quick question to help frame this up here. Because, Tim, you have also talked about, when James Hansen was here, you talked about this. This can very much be a conservative solution. It can be a progressive solution. It can be both. It can be worked together here. How do you frame these discussions about our planet and climate change solutions?
Yeah, thanks. And thanks again very much, Evan, for this opportunity.
Sure.
So to me, it's a fundamental opportunity for reflection on each of our parts. And I'm talking about all of us. All of us now talking and discussing and listening and as you were mentioning, Republicans, Democrats, gay, straight, young, old.
Greens, everyone, libertarians.
Absolutely. Seriously. In all manner and form. The two questions I think are critical are to ask ourselves individually is simply this. One is, what do we have in common? What do we have in common? And then secondly, what is it that we love? What do we love? So if we begin to get a hold of what comes out of the heart, what comes out of our guts in terms of each of these responses, I think we begin to have something to work with in terms of a way to engage each other, in terms of a way of talking that is without polemics, without, as we were talking earlier, this vilifying, this demonizing of people with different ideas. So those are the two questions. What is it that we have in common that we can each ask ourselves as individuals? And what is it that each of us loves? Let's start there.
Well,
in this whole discussion.
Then you have to answer it first and take the second one. What is it that we love? How would you answer that question?
Good. well, I'll begin quite naturally with my family and with, I'm thinking in particular of our grandchildren, all four of whom we have now with us as of a week and a half ago. Family in a fundamental way, but I also love, I love life. I love the earth. I love nature. I love the wordless majesty of the planet. I love the air we breathe, the water we drink. So there's something about enhancing that, something about nourishing that within each and all of us that moves me, that gives me hope. The other thing is that we are part of creation. And we are inherently a creative species by definition. So that's what gives me, in the long term, that's what gives me the hope. We are presented with a problem, as Adam Frank says, that our attitude towards climate change can be, whoops, you know, okay, so we've done this since the Industrial Revolution. Now we know what we've done. All right, what do we need to do to address this? So it's taking responsibility and relying on this enormous wellspring of human creativity in terms of response to the issue.
One point there for our panelists, and then we're going to move into the kind of the nitty-gritty on the fee and dividend, which should not be boring. If I'm a bad host, it'll be boring. I think this should be important. This is important. We're talking about mechanisms and trade and the TPP tomorrow. That shouldn't be boring either if I'm doing my job. These things really matter. But just to follow up on Tim's point, there's one thing that I go back to former Congressman Inglis's TEDx talk, which I've posted on our Twitter account, our producer Megan Mack at MMack Media. She'll post it as well if you want to find it and check it out yourself, and you really should. Toward the end of that presentation, he said this is where conservatives and progressives sometimes get divided on dealing with climate, or at least grappling with what we should do. And he said conservatives tend to fear that progressives want us to eat bugs and to freeze in the winter and to sweat all summer and to not use any energy at all. And conservatives want a world that's maybe clean powered, but still you're allowed to turn the lights on. And I know that, you know, he's saying that for effect. I know he doesn't actually believe that. I mean, maybe some. And there's some bugs that might actually be surprisingly nutritious. But the bottom line is, I think what he's saying is the divide is conservatives are suspicious, Tim, that when you say we love the earth and we love the air and we love the water, what we really want is to force people to have smaller houses and less stuff. And I think part of the discussion about what we love is part of grappling with the fact that we think we love stuff, but most of us don't really love stuff. We love people and experience. Mm-hmm. But and that's part of the discussion. But how would you respond to what former Congressman Inglis is saying with this concern that conservatives have that ultimately, I don't want to hunt and gather again, Tim?
Sure. All right. Now,
can I add something about that?
Mark, why don't you start?
I think there's something really important that Tim was getting at there. You know, former Senator Warner of Virginia, it just seems like, you know, if your last name's Warner, you always get elected to the Senate in Virginia, but not the current version, but the older version, didn't seem interested at all in climate change and seemed against anything I would be for. And then suddenly he comes out very strongly in favor of doing something about climate change, and here's what we found out. He loves to fly fish, and apparently trout are very sensitive to changes in temperature. So the area in which he can fly fish is diminishing. And so we have something very specific that he loves, like Tim's talking about things he loves about the planet. Senator Warner loves fly fishing. And now he sees that he doesn't have as much area to fly fish in, and we do know we can connect with people on that very fundamental level. I think part of the thing we've been working really hard on is, and I think you did accurately characterize where the divide is between conservatives and liberals on this, is that we all need to get a little bit better at listening to each other, not lecturing each other about what we should know about this, but listening so that we can actually hear what people's concerns are.
I agree.
You know, one of the things that when we can get to people, that it becomes obvious to both liberals and conservatives, is we have a proposal that is both entirely libertarian and at the same time the most progressive answer to the problem. It's libertarian in that all we do is correct a market failure and let the market go to work. It's progressive in that most of people's carbon footprint isn't in their energy use. It's actually in what they buy. And poor people don't buy that much stuff. So actually poor people come out the very best in our proposal, where you put a steadily increasing fee on carbon and you give all the money back to households. The problem is people usually hear what they think you're going to say, not what you're saying, and it just gets easier for them to hear you if, first of all, you can demonstrate that you will listen to them and not just lecture them about what you think they should be doing.
I think that is a beautifully framed narrative there. Abby, you want to jump in there too? Go ahead.
Well, I think just what I have really appreciated about my experience as being a CCL volunteer is that they have given me the tools and trained me on how to do exactly that, how to connect with people, our representatives in particular, but also people in the community, on that level of finding common ground from a basis of respect, not looking to place blame, point fingers, but looking to move forward with solutions. And you know, I am not a paid lobbyist. I am a citizen lobbyist. And so they've provided that training that I need to learn how to sit down with members of Congress and have a meaningful discussion about this.
Or neighbors.
Or neighbors, yes,
or
absolutely.
Or people you meet on the street. Because I think what Mark reminds us is when we ascribe inferior motives to people, which I've been guilty of. I mean, that's probably human nature to some degree, to think that somebody who disagrees with you must have inferior motives. But when you do that, you stop listening to what they're saying. And again, as Mark just said, you assume you know what they're going to say already. And Tim McGowan, why don't you go and jump
in? And part of this as well is letting go of labels and stereotypes. So it seems that the era of these, you know, categorizations and silos that we put each other in ideologically, culturally, we are so far past that place in terms of what is happening to the Earth, what is happening around the planet, that the real invitation is to let's let go of those labels. As Abby was saying, let's sit down, let's talk, let's acknowledge a common core of respect and of the value of whatever it is the other person has to say or is feeling or thinking. So part of this is a cultural thing. So, you know, you mentioned a kind of an extreme, you know, insect eaters to you know, yacht,
yeah, right.
Yachtlers. And the reality is that what we're about at a fundamental way is the inherent fundamental unity of the human, you know, of the human experience on Earth. I mean, honestly, that's really what it's about. And so the sooner that we can just relax and let go of some of these things, the better conversation we'll have.
Abby?
Although in some ways, I'm not going to contradict what Tim just said, but to add on to it in a from a different viewpoint, Another real strength of CCL's, the carbon fee and dividend policy, is that it doesn't necessarily require that people want to do the right thing or be invested in whatever level at protecting the environment. When it comes down to it at the end of the day, carbon fee and dividend is just about making the economically smart choice for your family. If we put a rising price on carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions, in about 10 years down the line, the price of renewables will be cheaper. So the products we buy, it will just be simply, well, duh, of course I'll buy that one. It's the better economic choice.
Yeah. So before we get into the 101, we're going to do carbon fee and dividend 101 right after the half hour break here. And then I want to work through any questions listeners have. Conservative listeners, if you are suspicious of this, if you're not buying what people like Bob Inglis, a Republican and a conservative, have said, that this does fit with conservative ideology, let us know why. But we're going to walk through some of the 101 of it in just a few minutes. So let me grab one phone call because Shauna wants to jump into the conversation before we do that. Go ahead, Shauna.
Hi. First of all, before the end of the program, I would like you to give out address, the phone number, and the hours of CPL, because I will say this is a bit of a failure of WXXI. They always bring up fascinating things, and you think, oh, gee, I wish I would send them some money, but I don't know where to, you know, or I'd love
sure.
to volunteer there or something. So don't do that this time.
Okay.
I've been looking around trying to find. Secondly, my concern about the environment has more to do with we have to take care of our island home. When the first people landed on the moon, Armstrong and company, they looked and they saw Earth rise and they saw our little planet, which was green and blue in the middle of a sort of bleak black universe, and they sort of fell in love with our Earth. And I did too, and I think we have to take care of it. Thirdly, has anybody thought what marvelous reason to need to cooperate internationally? Everybody on the globe is going to have to work to save our planet. And what could the fallout be in terms of getting along between nations and so forth?
Yeah. Shauna, let me just jump in because you've given us a lot there, and I'm going to work backwards. After we lay out the 101 of carbon fee and dividend, we're going to have Mark and Tim and Abby explain as best they can why this not only matters for us, but why the plan has to include reaching out to China, reaching out around mm-hmm. the world, and that why there is optimism that that could actually happen. I think there's a lot of cynicism that if we stick our necks out, we'll be alone and India and China will bury us. That may not be the case. I promise we will get to it, but it's a great point, Shauna. And before we go any further, I'm not going to wait till the end of the program. Abby, Tim, CCL, local chapter, you want to get involved? How do you do that, Abby?
Well, you can find us at citizensclimatelobby.org. You can, our local chapter, we do have information on there. Also, we have a Facebook page. And our meetings are held every third Monday of the month at the First Unitarian Church. And feel free to reach out to me personally, abigailmchugh@hotmail.com. Send me an email.
And just to add to that as well, if you can click on join on the website, mm-hmm. You'll get an invitation to a weekly introductory call that describes all of CCL and the carbon fee and dividend, and as well as an invitation to join our group locally. But there's a lot of information. It's a phenomenally well-done website. But citizensclimatelobby.org and click on join. Just give your email address, and you'll get a monthly newsletter.
All right. Tim McGowan is the guy who founded the local chapter, and Abby McHugh Griffa is the co-leader of the local chapter. On the phone with us is Mark Reynolds, who's the executive director of the National Citizens Climate Lobby. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back. And if you've been wondering, so tell me again, what is this carbon fee and dividend? How would it work? Is it really revenue neutral, or you know, how does it impact taxes and the economy? We're going to work through that next. Coming up in our second hour, The Stage offers a chance for playwrights to talk about serious issues in the African American community. From the impact of slavery to the bonds formed by young mothers during slavery to modern questions such as getting along with law enforcement, community building, even a question about snitching. We're talking about Sankofa. The festival, the 9th annual, launches Thursday, and we'll talk to the playwrights. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mark Reynolds is the executive director of the National Citizens Climate Lobby, and he has described this proposal to help mitigate climate change as one that may appeal to libertarians and Greens and Republicans and Democrats. It sounds like a unicorn, but it may actually be real. It's called the Carbon Fee and Dividend. And Mark, for people who have not heard about it, let's walk through as best you can, educate people on how it would work.
Okay, good. So first of all, 85% of economists believe that a straightforward carbon fee is the most efficient way to deal with global warming. One of the things they say is if you want less of something and you want less of something quickly, the fastest way to do so is to make it more expensive. And an example they would cite is cigarette smoking. You know, more than half of Americans used to smoke, now less than 20% do. And why they say education contributed to that, they say the biggest factor was simply raising the price. So what they say is, you know, there is a market failure in the cost of burning fossil fuels right now, in that when you fill up your car with gas, you're not paying the true cost, because there's other costs that are associated with that. Part of that is military spending to protect oil interests. Part of that is the greater frequency and severity of weather-related events, which the scientists have been telling us are coming, and we're certainly seeing more droughts and flooding. So what they're and the health-related costs. So what they say is, begin to incorporate what economists call externalities, what you and I might say the cost to society, in the direct price. So in carbon fee and dividend, we begin to assess a fee on per ton burning of fossil fuels, essentially CO2 and any other greenhouse gases. But what we do different than what's been proposed before is we take every single dollar from that fee and we send it back to American households. Why do we send all the money back? Well, first of all, almost every Republican member of the House has signed something called a Grover-Norquist tax pledge, which obligates them to not vote for any new tax that grows the government. So if we give all the money back to households, they can still honor their pledge and vote for the fee. Two, anything you do to mitigate global warming by putting an effective price in place will increase costs for people. So what we want to make sure is that it's obvious to people that their cost is being mitigated. So James Hansen, who's on our board, I think most people think our country's leading climate scientist, says that if it's not obvious to households, if they're not getting the check, it won't be obvious that their cost is being mitigated. Former Secretary of Schultz, who it differs from many conservative economists who think that a tax swap would be better, he said the reason that you also give the check back as a monthly check is you need the most honest, most transparent, hardest to rig system. So we give all the money back to households so it's obvious that their increases cost is being mitigated while we make the transition to renewable energy. The third piece of the proposal is a border assessment. We've talked to the best WTO scholars, and what they tell us is that we could put a fee on goods coming in from China and India if they don't have their own fee. Now, China is launching 7 provincial cap-and-trade programs, so they do have their own plan for a price. But what the border adjustment does is it protects American manufacturers, and more importantly, what it does is it incentivizes countries, if they didn't have a fee, to put a fee in place because they would rather keep that money than having it go to us. So it's very simple and straightforward. You put a fee on carbon-based fuels, just like the economists say is the most efficient way to change behavior. You give all the money back to households, and then you put an assessment at the border, both to protect American manufacturers, but more importantly, to incentivize other countries to make sure that their price is equivalent to ours.
Mark, the criticisms usually start with this idea that this kind of fee would simply have companies responding by raising costs to the public. And and sort of negating any positive benefit. What's the answer to that?
Yeah, so I think every business that can pass the cost through will. And that's why the giving the money back to households is so essential. You know, there's a lot of ways you could price carbon. Ours is the only one that makes sure that households come out ahead. So not every household, because rich people buy a lot of stuff. So this is going to hurt them a little bit more than poor people. But for people who have any type of modest carbon footprint at all, they'll actually end up with a little bit more money than their increase in cost. So, yeah, if you didn't give the money back to households, this could be a big problem for everybody. The other thing to think about is, you know, because people think, won't this hurt the economy? Well, if you think about doing what we're proposing, putting a $15 per ton fee and then raising that $10 a year, by the second year, you're circulating hundreds of billions of dollars in the economy, and you're putting in the pockets of people who spend it. So there's studies out there, and you could look on our website for something called the Remmer Report that show that those hundreds of billions of dollars are actually overall stimulative to the economy, would produce an increase in GDP, and at the same time would be adding millions of jobs. So, you know, when Bob Inglis talks about a false narrative that it's either the economy or jobs, it's just not the case. But it really is essential that the treatment of the revenue is done right, or it could be harmful to households, it could be harmful to the economy. That's why we're so adamant that 100% of the money go back as a dividend, so that everybody is made whole that can be, and that also we have a chance to both clean the air and water and stimulate the economy.
All right, Mark, here's another criticism I have heard, which is that the intention is not to harm the economy, not to harm taxpayers, but to harm the fossil fuel industry, of which we can certainly consume too much of right now. The question is, can we scale up to meet energy needs if the fossil fuel industry suffers in the way that some people hope that it will with a fee and dividend? In other words, is there something to replace it fast enough to meet energy needs?
Yeah. So, boy, we could spend 2 hours on that, but let's just say a few things. First of all, Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, is for a carbon tax because what businesses want more than anything else is predictability. They have built carbon pricing into their own organization. So if you look at the big major oil companies, they've actually built an internal carbon price because they know there has to be one, and they know that there has to be a transition away from fossil fuels. Now, the coal industry is different. People worry about coal workers, but coal mining is basically gone. There used to be 500,000 coal miners in the U.S. Now there's about 70,000. That didn't happen because of regulation. That happened because coal companies figured out how to automate their process, and then natural gas kicked their butt. So coal is essentially an industry that's almost gone. I mean, we certainly feel for those 70,000 coal miners that are still there and would certainly want to do what we could to help them find other employment. But because this is a generational transition, we know that their kids aren't going to go into coal mining. They're going to find something else to do because that industry has essentially disappeared. One other piece. There's a gentleman named Mark Jacobson at Stanford. He's one of several scholars who've looked into, could you actually generate all of the world's energy with renewable sources? And what Mr. Jacobson's work shows is that you could do it if you wanted to ramp up in a World War II kind of way in 20 years. If you did it at a more leisurely pace, you could do it in 40 years. But the good thing to know is that there are viable places to get all of the world's energy from renewable sources. So the problem is, can we transition? Yes, we can make the transition. We just need the incentive in the marketplace to make that transition happen a little quicker than it is.
Now, here comes some of the questions and criticism from listeners in the forms of emails, and I want to work through a couple of them.
Sure.
Tim writes to us and says, not sure how China gets on board with this. They are building more coal-fired plants and will be significantly adding to them in 2018. It seems hard to get them to slow down. Again, that's Tim writing to the program, I think expressing a common concern. So let's start with this, Mark. If we do this, we really do need to not, well, I think the world needs China, India, et cetera, to get on board pretty quickly too, don't we? And doesn't the world need that?
Absolutely. And China is planning, I mean, you know, cap and trade is not my favorite solution, but China does have cap and trade programs that they're implementing in their provinces. And the other problem that China has is, you know, the life expectancy is 7 years less in the north than the south where all the coal mines are. And China's having a huge brain drain of young, educated people leaving the country because they're not willing to live in that kind of environment. So they are planning their own internal price on carbon. Yes, China's a big problem. They emit more than we do. We still, you know, as a net basis, because we put so much CO2 in the atmosphere and it stays up there so long, we still put the majority of up there. But, yeah, we do need China to come along, and that's why it's so crucial that the border adjustment language is written effectively so that it's not just that China has a price on carbon, but it has a price that is as substantial as ours, so it significantly reduces also. We can't do this alone. We can lead the world, but this is going to require worldwide cooperation. Not everybody was a fan of it, but I thought it was pretty remarkable that 180 countries agreed in Paris that we needed to hit some meaningful goals. So we are seeing some worldwide progress, and I think more importantly, we're seeing some really interesting things with this Congress that nobody could predict. You know, this year we formed the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. That's 8 Republicans and 8 Democrats. I don't think anybody else would even say you should try and do that, but because we have strong people in the field, like Abby, like Tim, we were able to spend 2 years building support in Carlos Corbello's district, bringing local people in so that he could feel comfortable as the Republican chair that when they form that committee, he would have support back home in the district.
Okay, so before Tim McGowan jumps in, let me just follow up one point there, Mark. So I don't know if Tim in Pittsford is still listening, and maybe he'll follow up and say, look, that satisfies me or that doesn't answer the question, but let me ask it a different way. What do you think China would do if a fee and dividend gets passed in the United States?
I think they will ramp up their own pricing mechanisms faster and at a higher rate. I mean, they were, by all accounts, we've been told when the House had passed Waxman-Markey and the Senate was debating doing something in 2009, they were ready to be pretty aggressive. And so I think that we would expect to see them be more aggressive seeing U.S. leadership. I mean, this is something where, you know, we've always led on the big issues. We need to do that again. And I think that there will be no problem with the rest of the world following.
Timothy,
I mean, that being said, yeah, there's 30 pricing mechanisms around the world. I mean, the European Trade Union, European Union has a cap and trade policy. British, almost every, in fact, every province in Canada has a pricing mechanism. California does, which is the 6th largest economy in the world. So it's not like we're talking about something that hasn't already happened. It has happened. We just need a uniform U.S. price to give the rest of the world reason to move faster.
Okay, Tim McGowan?
Sure, a couple things. Excuse me, just on one on China and one on what gives hope in Congress currently in terms of movement on climate change policy. China is the leading producer of solar panels. We are buying back solar panels from China. So globally they have, I mean, their market for panels is enormous and they're producing at quite a rate. They also have invested about $89 billion in renewables in the last, I think that's a 2014 figure, to our $56 billion. So they know it. They know it very clearly. If you see through the incredibly dense fog and pictures of images of Beijing, they are moving much more than meets the eye or the normal kind of information we get. The other thing that's really critical, our talk earlier, Evan, about hope and about, you know, movement on policy. Mark mentioned this Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus. It's really a pretty fundamental advance. So it's a process whereby people are invited to join from each party, one Republican with one Democrat at a time. And it's fundamentally going to be a think tank in the House for the formulation of climate change policy. It's a big deal. And one of our leading lobbyists, this guy Jay Butera, has worked in Florida for several years to put together the co-sponsorship of this caucus, which is one Democrat from Florida and one Republican, this Carlos Coelho that Mark mentioned. So that's a key thing. The other thing more locally on a relative scale is that in New York State, Chris Gibson is the retiring member of Congress from Albany, where Senator Gillibrand used to have a seat. And in the spring in recent months, he has put together this thing called the Gibson Resolution for House Republicans only. And so it now has at least 13 members, including 4 or 5 from New York State. So, Evan, what this resolution says to Republicans is, we are concerned about climate change, we believe it is human-caused, and we need to do something about it on a federal policy level. So that's big. That's all Republicans, including people like Tom Reed locally, like Elise Stefanik in the North Country, like Richard Hanna retiring. I think there's one or two others from New York State alone, but they're 13 nationally.
And is that why, Abby McHugh Griffa, one of the reasons that you said there is more optimism out there in terms of this doesn't have to be a right versus left paradigm?
That is one of the reasons. And also, you know, my experience in Washington was having conversations with Republicans, they are listening. And clearly, the conversation has changed over the past several years, from flat-out denial to the next step being, oh, I'm not a scientist, I can't comment on this, to now being willing to sign this resolution and put your name on it as a Republican. And really, in our meetings in Washington with staffers or with the congressmen themselves, you know, they're smart people. They recognize that there's a problem. They're in a very politically tricky position, especially with the upcoming election. You know, I don't think anyone wants to rock the boat too much on the Republican side right now. But I think we have some really, I think there's reason to hope, especially after the elections, that we're going to see some pretty quick movement on this.
Okay. And one of our callers earlier just wanted to know about getting in touch. Abby mentioned email her directly, the website, et cetera. But other listeners have said, look, for people who can't get online, is there a phone number to call? Is there a way to get in touch that way?
Well, I don't know if there's a national number. Mark might share that with us. But again, my phone number, call me, 607-342-4334. You know, the way I got started in this.
Do it again.
Absolutely. 607-342-4334. And the way I got my start as a climate organizer in town was just simply reaching out to people who I knew were interested in this. And I'd be happy to help others do the same.
Okay.
Right. And if people wanted to call my office, our headquarters are in San Diego. The direct line that rings in my office is 619-437-7142.
Okay, so there's an opportunity for you to get in touch in different ways here. We got about just under 10 minutes left, and I want to work through more of your questions. If you want to call, I see the phone ringing again. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Questions about the carbon fee and dividend. Any concern, maybe a view that you're skeptical or not about it? Are you liking what you're hearing? Conservatives, we want to hear from you. Here's another email from a conservative named Art. He self-identifies. He says he's a conservative who feels like inevitably this would grow the government more. Mark, I know that's something else you've heard. This proposal, would it grow the government more?
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that why we get so much enthusiasm from Republican members that we meet in the House and Senate is because specifically, this doesn't grow the government. We don't fund any projects. What we do is we simply take every single dollar and we send it back to households. Is there some administrative cost? Of course there is. There's some administrative cost to collecting it, and there's some administrative cost to sending it out. But we have that kind of infrastructure. People get their Social Security checks. People got one-time rebates from the government during the Bush and Obama administration. So it's not like we're having to create this whole new bureaucracy. Yeah, there's going to be some administrative costs. There will be some to collecting, there will be some to giving it, but every single dime will come from the program. So we don't increase any government spending. We pay for ourselves. It is 100% revenue neutral. So it is the least intrusive option. You can't think about this only by itself. There's really three options for dealing with global warming. One is you could do what we say, which is put a fee on carbon, give all the money back to households. You could have a cap-and-trade program, which does require quite a bit of government bureaucracy and oversight, or you could use regulation. So the question is, which of those is the least intrusive? Well, the by far the least intrusive is putting the straightforward fee and giving all the money back to households as your option. So the option of not doing anything is clearly not an option. We've already seen what's happening to the planet by not doing something. So then the question is, which is the most market-friendly, and ours is the most market-friendly. That's why you have people like Bob Inglis and George Shultz being such enthusiastic supporters for it.
All right, Andrew in Irondequoit wants to weigh in with a question as well. Go ahead, Andrew.
I like the market-friendly, but I worry that the Democrats will sabotage it because they don't like anything market-friendly. But I also wonder if this is a backdoor way to get some kind of worldwide government going.
Okay, Andrew, can I ask you real quick, Andrew, why do you think Democrats don't like anything market-friendly? I mean, that
are you
is...
kidding me? Give me a break. Come on, Evan. They don't like anything market-friendly. Look at the disaster that Obamacare is and all that kind of stuff. They just don't.
Okay, so, Andrew, I'm going to let you go. I will honor the second part of your question and not the sort of absurd, extreme first part of it. But the second part is this a worldwide government we're headed toward? Mark Reynolds?
Well, I mean, what our efforts are focused on this Congress, this House, this Senate. That's what we're working on, you know, having the U.S. show leadership on this, trying to get a U.S. policy passed. So I have no idea about any of the other side of that, but I know what we're working on. And what we're working on is working with this particular Congress. You know, we have about 1,200 meetings with congressional offices a year. You know, I like one of the things that I saw former President Clinton say about 10 years ago, and he said he wished more Americans would actually sit down with their elected officials because they would find out that they're more informed, they're smarter, and they probably seem more honest than what you expect. So, you know, I know there's skepticism out there about things, and it's easy to be skeptical. We just wish more people would sit down and listen to their members of Congress and their staff. They're really, for the most part, really remarkable, interesting people who ask good questions and take good notes. So, you know, there's that. And you know, I know there's skepticism from some conservatives that liberals are in favor of market-based approach. But we get enormous amount of enthusiasm from both sides of the aisle about what we're trying to do. I think that if there's one thing all politicians are really good at, it's sniffing political winds. They can tell when things are changing. And I don't think that there's any way we could have formed the Bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus this year unless members of Congress could see that things are changing and we're going to be able to take action. We have strong indication from three Republican offices that they'll be introducing pricing legislation next year. They do need to all get through this craziest of all ever campaign season. But we've always believed that to get something done on climate, it either needs to be bipartisan or introduced by Republicans, because it becomes partisan the minute that Democrats introduce it. And we think that a lot of hard work behind the scenes in the district should pay off next year.
All right, we got to keep it tight. Tim and Abby want to weigh in there too. Go ahead,
sure,
Tim.
Just to briefly, I want to address the caller's comments on the, will this lead to worldwide government? The climate change is a worldwide problem. It's a problem for all of life on Earth. It's a species problem. So the resolution is not going to be a worldwide government. The resolution on a global scale will come more from the kind of thing that happened in Paris last December, in which all the nations virtually of the Earth, almost 200, gathered, and their leaders, deeply concerned about the common good of their people and their land, gathered to formulate the beginnings of a global policy within their own nation states on climate change. So it's not going to be a government, but it is going to be a fundamental economic and social initiative of unprecedented scale.
Yeah, I mean, I think Andrew's comment is he's not the first to express that concern. But if we knew there was a comet coming at the planet, and we said, we've got this idea for building the shield, and we'd like China to do it too, I don't think people would stand up and say, whoa, what are you trying to do, build a worldwide government? You know, I'm not stopping that comet unless you promised me that this is not a worldwide government. Sometimes worldwide standards are required to fight existential threats. And I do have a caller who wants to jump in and with a question or a comment for Abby, I think, on the local level. Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah. Well, my comment just is that, like, with this very, very important issue, not unlike others, but this is one of the most critical issues, is that I was hoping the organization includes doing a lot of outreach to neighborhood groups. Some of those groups are community groups that are known by name. Others are not, because they're smaller and they're. And there's an emerging thing in the city about the residents taking over more control of what happens in their neighborhoods. So there really is, even though maybe it doesn't get in the news. And that's a switch for the city, because they're used to telling people what to do, not involving them as much. So those opportunities, those movements also offer opportunities to include things like this. But the organizers of these things have to be the ones that outreach to the neighborhood groups, some of which they probably know some of the names of them, but not all. So you got to kind of, you know, work that out. But they can't expect these poor neighborhoods who are burdened with 20,000 things to then each one of them join up, call, because they don't even know.
Yeah, Bonnie, I just got to jump in because we're literally almost out of time. Abby, go ahead.
Absolutely, Bonnie. We definitely understand the need to outreach in the community and are doing that. In fact, we have a presentation that we can give to any neighborhood group, business association, and contacting us to help set that up. For any group that might be interested, we can do that. And we are, of course, looking for opportunities on our own. And again, citizensclimatelobby.org. Anyone who wants to get involved, we need your energy, and we'd appreciate your help.
You see what happens here? We always fly through the hour. And so Mark Reynolds from the National Citizens Climate Lobby, where can people jump online to learn a little bit more and maybe share information about carbon fee and dividend?
CitizensClimateLobby.org. Thanks so much for having me, Evan.
Mark, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch. We'll see if Bob Inglis will come join us, and you know we'll talk a little bit more directly to our conservative listeners. But that's Mark Reynolds, who is the executive director of the National Citizens Climate Lobby. Tim McGowan is he is the founder of the local chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. And one more time, if you want to call Abby McHugh Griffa, we have people who say, give me that number again, they want to call.
607-342-4334. I look forward to hearing from you.
All right, Abby, thank you. Tim McGowan, thank you very
much. Thanks very much, Evan.
More connections straight ahead.